Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast, and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. And already we're at the second show of 2016, so we had Christmas, then the New Year celebrations, and here we are, the New Year of 2016, well and truly in full swing, but the weird weather here in the UK goes on, more and more and more rain, and more spring temperatures. As I look out the window now, it's kind of, 10 past 4 or so as I'm recording this. A bright afternoon, and again, I'm recording this in a T-shirt. I just have a feeling the weather's going to get some revenge on us very soon, and it's going to freeze. But, you can't believe what the newspapers predict. Usually when it comes to weather stories, they're well wrong. I'm going to do some shout-outs, and then we're going to do a very special guest, the return of David Icke. Now, I get about one email at least per week asking, where is David Icke? Can we have him back? David's life has been very interesting in the last year or two. He started his own media operation, so we'll get an update on that. And also, I thought we'd just randomly cherry-pick some of the topics relevant to this new year. How the world has changed, and what his view of it is now. Because it is a new reality, it seems to me, that we're staring down the barrel of. So David Icke is the guest. Thank you very much to Adam at Creative Hotspot for his hard work getting the show out to you and curating the website. Adam is the absolute linchpin of this show. Thank you to Martin, by the way. Haven't had a chat with Martin for a while. So Martin, the man who did the theme tune, if you are listening to this, please get in touch, Martin. Just nice to know that you're there and you're okay. So before we talk to David Icke, I've got time for some shout-outs, not very many. A lot more emails over the last week from listeners in the UK. So come on, North America, Canada and the US, and South America and Australia. My friends in South Africa, get those emails coming in. Because you're going to be beaten for numbers by listeners in the UK. Wherever in the world you are, good to hear from you. And if you do email, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use this show. I love to hear your stories, and it helps me to pitch the show. Let's first of all return to the subject of the price of certain books by authors that I feature on this show. One that was mentioned was David Paulides, and some of you finding his books expensive on Amazon, and one listener pointing out in the last edition why that was. Emma backs that up. A number of listeners have said this, that if you buy the book on Amazon, some people resell them and try and bump up the price to ridiculous levels, because, says Emma, David doesn't use Amazon to sell his book. Emma says she finds Missing 411 fascinating, so I have listened to a few of the interviews, and he's mentioned this and suggested go to his website to buy the book. And the website, I'm happy to mention again, it's canammissing.com. That's canammissing.com. And Emma, thanks for pointing that out. So just beware of people trying to make a big, fat, quick profit out of you by reselling books, because there are other ways to get them and pay a fair price. Peter in Weymouth, nice to hear from you. David in Hexham, Northumberland. I'm looking into that missing person case. Could be one for David Paulides, I think. Thanks, David. David in Central Coast, New South Wales, Australia, says, "G'day, Howard. Have you done a story about Apollo 18 and its moon landing? I've just watched the movie and was wondering if it was all a hoax." It has been mentioned by a couple of guests, David, but it is something that we need to do a standalone show about sometime. Thank you for that. Holly, nice to hear from you again. Glad you enjoyed the time travel show, Holly. Jeff in Huntingdon, UK, thanks for the Graham Hancock story. I'll tell that on the show one of these days, thank you. Aidan Crowley, thanks for the good wishes, Aidan. Nikki in Kenya, nice to hear from you again. Marcus in Reading, Berkshire, says, "I've come to the conclusion that once you die, it's just the physical body that dies, but consciousness is a fundamental force of the universe that cannot be destroyed." I think that's probably how I'm inclined to believe too, Marcus in Reading, Berkshire. That, you know, we must go on in some form. Otherwise, what is the point? A new listener in New Brunswick, Canada. Thank you very much indeed for your email, Heather in New Brunswick, Canada. Lost your name there for a second, Heather. Thank you very much for finding the show, and thank you for the nice things you've said. New Brunswick is, I think, where Stanton Friedman, the great ufologist, lives as well. Matt in the West Midlands, UK. Kind comments. Thank you, Matt. Edward in Portsmouth, Hampshire, a place I know very well. Happy New Year. I worked on Ocean FM down in Portsmouth and Southampton and Fareham some years ago. Michael in Lancashire says, "I started listening to your show about 3 years ago while I was living in Perth, Western Australia, and I tell as many people as possible to visit your site and have a listen because I really like your impartial approach and the variety of topics that you do. I was wondering if you've ever covered the topic of Satanism in the world elite." Well, somebody who knows a lot about world elites as David Icke. I'll try and run that past him. Remind me, will you? And finally, to Alan and Obi. Nice to hear from you both, too. And that is the shout-outs. If you would like to get in touch with the show, maybe get mentioned on it, if you've got any questions or guest suggestions, email me via the website, theunexplained.tv. That's www.theunexplained.tv. Let's get now to the Isle of Wight, which is just off the coast from Portsmouth, and talk to David Icke. David, lovely to have you back on the show. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Howard.
Hey, David, listen, thanks very much for coming on here, because, you know, I talk to some busy people on this show, but I think you must be the busiest, what with a book due out and another tour. Life is pretty hectic by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, it's hectic, but good. It's interesting. I think Gandhi talks about a sequence where this is not exactly what he said, but the gist of it. First, they ignore you. First, they, then they ridicule you. Then they attack you. Then you win. And I'm not talking about then I win, but that sequence I can definitely see in my own life.
Well, when you think about the way things have transformed for you when you appeared, and, you know, we'll only talk about it obliquely here, but when you appeared on television all of those years ago and were, frankly, ridiculed, not only by the host, but by the audience of a chat show, yeah. And how life has turned around and how now people are beginning to identify with so many of the things that you've been saying. That's not to say that, you know, everybody's going to agree with every word that you say, because, you know, this is the real world and they won't. But one thing that has come to my attention, and it's made me laugh over the last few months, driving home from work, I tend to listen to one of the big London phone-ins. And pretty much every day, somebody will come out to the phone-in host with one of the points that you've raised in one of your books or I've heard you say in the media. And the phone-in host will be taken a little bit aback and then say, you've obviously been reading David Icke. What that says to me is that the stuff that you've been coming out with for all of these years is now filtering down to, quotes, ordinary people in the mainstream.
Yeah, well, I think what it is, Howard, is that world events and the way that society is going, quite demonstrably, is getting people to reevaluate the way they see the world. And it's kind of interesting you mentioned that Wogan show, because in June, I'm going to do an all-day event at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, which is where that Wogan show came from.
Yeah, the old BBC TV theatre.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In what was it, 1991, to mark 25 years since that show. And it is remarkable that having booked that a long time ago, that this change is happening in the way that people see what I do. But it is world events. I mean, the official story of the way the world's going and why is making no sense to more and more and more people. And explaining it as a pre-planned sequence with the excuses used to make that pre-planned sequence happen is making much more sense to people now. And because I've been researching this full time for 26 years now, so I started a year before the Wogan show, and I've been all over the world researching it. What I've been able to put together in terms of the plan for the world and the methods of manipulation to get us there is now becoming blatantly obvious and, like I say, making sense to more and more people. And there are many levels to it, but on a level that people can immediately relate to without going, you know, too deep into apparently far out things that are not, the plan is for what I call the Hunger Games Society. And I call it that because it's basically the same themes as the Hunger Games movies. And that is a tiny elite in the real world, if you like, case about less than 1%, controlling all the wealth, all the government, all the decisions, all the business, everything. Then at the bottom, a mass population in servitude and poverty and deprivation, serving that less than 1%. and between them, a vicious, merciless police state to impose the will of the few on the many and maintain that structured status quo.
Okay, well, I can see evidence everywhere of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. Statistics tell you that all the time. It's no big secret, and all the charities are saying that too. What I don't see that much evidence of, certainly in the UK, US may be a different case, I don't know, I don't see that much evidence of the police state. Where is that?
Well, we're looking in different eyes. I mean, I do see it. And interestingly, this very day, a member of the Australian Parliament has come out and said that Australia is now clearly in a pre-police state situation. In America, it's unbelievable. I mean, if you go on to YouTube, I mean, go on my site most days, and you see the absolute explosion of videos detailing and portraying police violence that you would never have seen on that scale before. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And what's happening, something I've been talking about for a long time, is that the system is systematically recruiting people with psychopathic tendencies. These are people with no empathy with the consequences for others of their actions, people that glory in having power over others, and people who have no remorse, people who are genetic liars. All these traits of psychopathic behavior are found in more and more people in the police. And when you talk to genuine police officers, and there are still many who are working in this situation, many of them will agree with you and say what a nightmare it is, the way the face of the police is changing. I mean, if you look at it, Howard, look how the police are even looking like the military. And, you know, this police state is not a national police state. That's not what is being planned, but a global police state, because the structure at the top, controlled by the less than 1%, is for a world government dictating to everyone on the planet, a world central bank dictating all global finance, a world currency, single electronic currency, cashless currency, which I've been writing about now since the early 1990s that this was coming. Look at it.
And I was very interested, David, to hear something on
Sweden, a virtually cashless.
I was about to say that. I heard that on domestic radio. Maybe you heard that too yesterday, that the Swedes are a hell of a long way down that road to a cashless society.
And yeah, but what you're looking at, Howard, is what I call the totalitarian tiptoe. And that is, you don't introduce something overnight because the change is so enormous that people kind of lift their heads from whatever they're doing and they go, what's going on? So it's done in stages. So we went from cash everywhere. I mean, I'm, you know, in my 60s now. So I remember the 50s when it was basically cash rules everything. Then we went to the credit card. And now we're going to the smartphone and this contactless system.
And you know, I'm not sure it's a good thing. I was at the bank yesterday, and a very nice lady who looks after my banking there, I actually got to see a real person. She was trying to twist my arm as far up my back as it would go to get me to go online banking, mobile banking. There are all kinds of incentives they're offering me to do this. And I am very suspicious, David.
Well, this has been planned a long time. I mean, what I'm talking about is not something that's been decided in the last few years. This goes back decades and decades and decades and decades. In my new book, it's out next week, Phantom Self, I quote at some length in one part of the book, a man from 1969 who was a insider, very, very close to the Rockefeller family. And one night, and for whatever reason, in 1969, he was a doctor who worked at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and was involved with Planned Parenthood, which is a Rockefeller organization. This is one of the ways that he got very close to the Rockefellers. And if the Rockefellers are involved, then it's part of this plan. And so he stood up at a an evening conference of pediatricians in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His name was Dr. Richard Day. And he asked everyone not to record what he had to say and not to take notes, because he was going to tell them how the world was going to change. Goodness knows why he felt to do it, but he did. And what he did in 1969 was detail what the plan was for the world. And one doctor, a guy called Dr. Dunnigan, who actually knew him in terms of worked with him at one point, I think as a subordinate, he decided he was going to take notes. And he did a series of interviews later, before he died in 2004, this Dr. Dunnigan, detailing what this Richard Day had said. And it's extraordinary. And things like he was describing the World Wide Web. That's supposed to have been invented at CERN in the 1980s. He was describing smart TVs, which didn't start circulating until, what, 2007, 2008? And he's talking about the cashless society. He's talking about the police state. He's talking about all these things because this is planned a long time ago. And I remember talking to someone in America who told me that in the 1970, her bank in Florida had decided they were going to get rid of checks. So she starts a campaign against this, which eventually led to the manager of the bank inviting them in to discuss their problem. And she explained all the things that would be wrong if they stopped using checks and stuff like that. And he said to her, to them, I do understand, but you know, it doesn't matter, because what's coming is a cashless society in which there is no money. Now, this is a bank manager in Florida in 1970. And it's if you are in the secret society networks at any kind of level, not everybody, nothing like everybody, but any kind of level, you get access to this projected plan. And so you can know what's coming long before anyone else. And it's planned. That's the point. All this stuff happening in the Middle East is all planned, quite demonstrably planned. You can show it in documents. You know, these countries that are being picked off in the Middle East, Libya, Iraq, Syria, they also want Iran. Know how they're now trying to, and indeed are, getting this conflict ramped up between the Shia Muslim world dominated by Iran and the Sunni controlled countries of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, etc., to create this conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims in the Middle East.
Mm. And yet, of course, publicly, our politicians here publicly, David, in the last 24 hours, 48 hours or so, have been trying to play all this down, haven't they? They've been trying to call for calm heads, if you'll pardon the expression, vis-a-vis the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They've been asking for people to step back from not exactly conflict, but aggression.
Well, what is said in the public arena for public consumption, for what they wish the public to perceive to be the goal, is very different to what's said and what is done in private. I've been writing for years and years that so-called Al-Qaeda, its offshoot now in Syria, Al-Nusra, and the offshoot of both of them, ISIS or ISIL or whatever you like, is a Western creation. And what's happening now is more and more people in the mainstream are starting to realize that that's the case. Because if you want to, this is the whole point of which encapsulates everything, really. Many, many years ago, way back in the 90s, I came up with a phrase called problem, reaction, solution to describe the most potent mass manipulation technique, perception manipulation technique of all. And that is where you covertly create a problem. You, through an unquestioning media, tell the public the version of the problem that you want them to believe. And you want the public to react to the problem, problem reaction, and the reaction is fear, outrage, and do something. Something must be done. And then those that have covertly created the problem and blame someone else, got the reaction, something must be done, then offer the solutions to the problems they have created. And those solutions are to change society in line with this plan. So if you have a status quo, Howard, at any point, whatever the status quo is, if the status quo is working and people are happy with it, it's very, very difficult to justify changing it. You're going to get resistance to that change. So the idea of problem, reaction, solution is that the problem destroys the status quo. Thus, another status quo is required to replace it, and they are the solutions. This is why Dr. Richard Day said in 1969 that what was coming was a pace of change that would get faster and faster, basically. That change would happen so quickly that a state of change would become the norm to people rather than a stage or state of stability. And the more that you can create problems, the more you create the excuse for solutions. So what we're having with what's gone on in the Middle East, the creation of ISIL, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, in all its different names and expressions, are creating the problem, which can then be used as an excuse to impose the solution. Without the creation of Al-Qaeda, without ISIL, without Al-Nusra, et cetera, there would be no justification for the invasion of country after country in the Middle East. So you create the problem. You see, you can put this into a provable, documentable sequence. In 2000, the year 2000, in the September, an organization in America called the Project for the New American Century, which included Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, of course, Cheney became deputy president to George Bush a few months later after this document came out. Donald Rumsfeld became defense secretary. Paul Wolfowitz became deputy defense secretary. And others who ran the Pentagon and were pillars of the Bush administration were all connected to this project for the New American Century and played a part in producing this document. This document called in September 2000 for America to fight multi-theater wars, as it called them, to take over and regime change a series of countries. These were including Libya, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and so on. These people came to power with Bush a few months later. And nine months after they came to power in January of the next year, January 2001, had the power to impose that what that document called for. And 9 months after they came to power, we had 9/11. And 9/11, where the official story makes no sense whatsoever when you look at it in detail and break it down, was the pump primer. It was the spark that started all this sequence that's gone on since of the war against terror, the use of the war against terror to justify invading countries and destroying freedoms at home in the name of protecting the public from terrorists, and all this was able to unfold. Now, if we go back to that document in September 2000, it said that this process of transformation, i.e. all these countries being regime changed, would necessarily be a slow process, quote, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. 1 year to the month after that document came out, America had what Bush actually referred to as our Pearl Harbor. Mm.
But David, can I just ask one quick thing? And you're in full flow here.
There's another ongoing from this, and that is a man called General Wesley Clark, who was one of the supreme commanders of NATO at one point. He went on a semi-alternative television show called Democracy Now! And this was in 2007, he was interviewed. And he said there, and you can go onto YouTube and you can see the interview, he said that a few days, literally days, after 9/11, he went to the Pentagon to see Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and other people he knew in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he said he met a general that he knew in the Pentagon. And the general said to him that they were going to invade Iraq. Now, remember, Howard, this is days after 9/11. And we are led to believe, though no one believes it now, that Bush and Blair were saying right up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, years later, that it could still be stopped if Saddam would get rid of weapons of mass destruction, which of course didn't exist. We're asked to believe that at the time when it was actually planned for years. So a few weeks later, Clark said, he came back to the Pentagon and he met the same general. And he said to him, because by then they are invading Afghanistan, he said to the general, what happened to invading Iraq? Why haven't we invaded Iraq? And the general said to him, it's worse than that. And he picked up a piece of paper. He said, I've just had this down from upstairs, i.e. Rumsfeld's office. We are going to invade 7 countries in 5 years. And what were the names on that list among them? Libya, Syria, Iran, and Iraq, etc. And so what we had was a plan to do what has unfolded, 9/11 to justify what has unfolded. And this is now being continued with more and more reasons to be fearful, parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., to justify picking off this list. And on this list, of course, is Iran. And that is part of the reason for what's going on currently in terms of this rift between the Sunni and the Shia world. And note this, these Sunni dominated countries like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, etc., they are countries that are assets of the West. And that's why Saudi Arabia can bomb mercilessly in Yemen without any criticism from the West, and why they can behead people on an unbelievable scale currently and have no condemnation from the West, indeed supported by the West to go on a United Nations committee dealing in human rights.
But isn't a lot of this about trade, David? If we go back to the 1980s, I think it was, maybe the 1970s, there was a documentary called Death of a Princess that we'll both remember. That caused an enormous diplomatic rift between the UK and Saudi. And at the end of the day, that was all smoothed over because of trade. We had to keep them sweet. If there was a plan, the question I wanted to ask you just before, if there was a plan that was so clear and smooth and cogent to invade these countries, take them over, get it all working in the way of the elites, what we've left in places like Libya, and if you look at the state of Syria now and Iraq, what we've left is a legacy of chaos. If it had all been part of a plan, wouldn't we have done it better?
Well, no, because what you want is chaos. Remember what I just said. I've said problem, reaction, solution. Actually, problem, reaction, solution can be described another way by quoting the motto of the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which is ordo ab chao, order out of chaos. And that's what problem, reaction, solution solution is. It's creating chaos in many and various ways, and then offering the solution out of the chaos. And therefore, you have this concerted plan to create maximum chaos. I mean, look at it, Howard. You've got chaos in the Middle East, which is creating mayhem. As a result of that mayhem, and this is long planned too, you have vast numbers of refugees and others who are not refugees pouring into Europe as a result of it. And you know, let me bring a few strands together here, because it all connects. Because it's a plan, it all connects. The structure that I described earlier, of world government, world central bank, world army, which I said way back in the 1990s, watch for NATO operating outside of the North Atlantic area it's supposed to defend. And now, of course, NATO's all over the place because it is a world army in the making to impose the will of the world government in this Hunger Games structure that I'm talking about. Now, under that structure of world government is designed to be a series of unions, the European Union being by far the most advanced, but we have now an African Union. There's planned to be a Middle East Union, a Pacific Union, an American Union, etc. And part of the plan for these unions is to end nation states, to end the sovereignty of nation states. And what they are facing in trying to do that, this is why, by the way, the European Union have put out maps over the years of a regionalized Europe, not one made up of countries, and the same has been done in the United States. The big pressure against that is people's sense of nationhood. Now, I come from the point of view personally that I am consciousness having an experience, where whatever I'm, people call me, man, English, whatever, that for me is an experience. It's not who I am. I'm consciousness having that experience. So nationalism and all this stuff is, I mean, I don't relate to that, but lots and lots of people do.
And well, what about this groundswell in America, David, with Donald Trump, who, you know, we're both aware of, aren't we, who seems to be doing incredibly well with the Republicans, very much playing to Reagan said, let's make America great. Trump's slogan is, let's make America great again.
Yeah, well, they use the same techniques all the time, depending on what they're trying to achieve. But the point is that this vast influx of people from the Middle East, many of whom are victims of this system, of this network themselves, are being used to break down the sense of nationhood, the sense of unique and identifiable culture. That is the biggest block for people accepting the absorption of their countries into these unions, like the European Union, on the basis of regionalization, not nationality. And one of the major countries in Europe where this sense of culture, this sense of national identity is so strong is Germany. And that's why they've been targeting particularly Germany. This is why Chancellor Merkel, who's just a front person for this network, like most of them, just put her hands up and people were going, what's she doing? What's she doing? Are all these people pouring in? Where are they going to go? And this is what it's all about. Now, if you go back to Dr. Richard Day in 1969, he said exactly this. He said, what we're going to do is we're going to have people pouring out of one area of the world into other areas of the world so that we break down a sense of nationhood. Because if you have a distinct culture, you are going to resist that. So we will do this to break down the sense of nationhood and what that nation is and what that culture is. That's not saying that this culture's right and that culture's wrong. This is not the level we need to be talking about. We need to be adult and mature and look beyond that. So what you have on one side in the so-called debate on immigration is one group of people saying there's nothing wrong at all with immigration. There's nothing wrong with vast numbers of people coming in. And on the other side, you've got the Trump mentality, and he's only a voice piece for that mentality, saying stop them all coming in. I mean, because they're basically, this is the undertone of what's being said by Trump, they're all potentially dangerous. Well, I would back the American regimes of the last 100 years or so as far more dangerous than the Muslim world in terms of what's gone on and the death and destruction that's been caused. The point is, we need to look at this in mature terms.
What do you think Trump is tapping into, David?
Well, he's tapping into a sense of national identity, of the, if you like, John Wayne America, and he's tapping into the four-letter word, which is the most important in this system of human manipulation, and that's fear. If you can get people in fear, they will invariably give their power away to anyone they believe will protect them from what they've been manipulated to fear. So what we have in Europe is genuine refugees and opportunists pouring into Europe. And the genuine refugees are absolutely victims of this this network, this manipulation, because they've been forced out of their homes by mass bombing. And on the other side, the population in the countries that are seeing this influx, they are in fear. They are unhappy deeply, many people, with seeing their what they perceive to be their culture overrun. And so you've got two victims of the same force, the same plan, being played off against each other. It's classic divide and rule.
Yeah, that looked at that way, that's what it sounds like.
Divide and rule. You've got the Democratic Party of Clinton and Obama, who basically will open the borders and have done. And then you've got Trump saying, build a wall. It's polarization. Polarization is divide and rule. And we need to look, and it's like the gun debate. We're now having all this pressure to disarm Americans. And the debate is, should Americans be allowed to have guns or not? The adult, mature question is, why is there such a campaign going on for year after year after year to disarm the American public at the same time that the American police are being armed to the teeth with military equipment?
And what do you say about the spate of shootings that we've seen in recent years, which certainly get a lot of media coverage? And it seems that every month there's something that happens in America where somebody walks into a school or a building or somewhere and opens fire, cinema, whatever.
Well, let's look at that. And you can bring it into terrorist events from 9/11 to Paris. You know, when things happen naturally, there is not an identifiable sequence which involves the authorities in the countries and then the situations that these attacks take place. And what I mean is this. There is a sequence which shows up every time that there is a, almost every time, there is a drill going on in the same area, a so-called, you know, practice, a scenario going on in the same area based on the same scenario that actually at the same time unfolds in real terms. So if you go back to 9/11, of all the days, in all the years, in all the places, there were scenarios going on in the skies over the eastern seaboard of the United States, where the 9/11 planes were involved, where there were practice scenarios happening, some of which, and at least one of which, involved a plane theoretically being flown into a building in Washington. This, these drills in the skies over the eastern seaboard, happening at exactly the same time as the 9/11 attacks, involved aircraft that would normally be on standby to react to hijackings in that region, organized and orchestrated by an organization called NORAD, which protects the skies over both the United States and Canada. As a result of the drill scenarios happening, those planes were not where they would normally be. And I've seen the documents detailing the sequence that happened involving NORAD that day, the documents detailing calls in, what was said, how they were reacted to. And again, you hear this: is this real or is this, in effect, drill? Because there was confusion, because suddenly these calls are coming in to NORAD's control centers talking about planes being hijacked or planes not responding in the same airspace that these drills were going on that NORAD was also involved in as part of the drill, as part of the practice.
And do you think that the drills were there to add to the fog of the day?
That's exactly what they were there to do, and they dramatically succeeded. Then you look at the 7/7 bombings in London. There were drills going on that involved the same stations, involving the same as the attacks.
Now, I might be dreaming this, and you can tell me if I'm completely wrong, because I can only half remember that I heard this somewhere in my stupor one night, but wasn't there some kind of drill around the time of the recent San Bernardino shooting?
Well, the location of the San Bernardino shooting is a location where they have many drills. They drill practices, so it's very frequently done there. But you look at the 7/7 bombings. A guy called Peter Power went on BBC Radio the afternoon of the 7/7 bombings and said the hairs on his neck were standing up because they were running a drill that morning based on the same scenario that actually happened. Why? Because it hides the real thing. Do you know the Oslo bombings that were followed by the shooting in 2011, the mass shooting? There was a police drill going on involving a bomb going off in Oslo in the same place where a real bomb went off 26 minutes after the drill ended. And then you go to Paris. There was a drill going on in Paris. In the most recent attacks in Paris that was based on a similar scenario. This continually repeats itself. Now, if we go back to the question you started out this sequence with, which is the shootings in America, in schools and other places, the times that those drills correspond with these shootings is staggering. For the same reason, it's almost not possible to hide these staged problem reaction solution scenarios.
And what do you think
the drill without the drill as cover?
Okay, what do you think about what happened over New Year, where we had Munich, wasn't it? Where there was a major panic there, Belgium, some celebrations were cancelled. There was a major alert there. What were those things about?
Well, we're getting a theme, aren't we? Are people in these countries now relaxed, calm, thinking straight, or are they in constant fear and constant concern of what could go on and what could happen. And the more that you can say, oh, no, we can't do this, we can't do that, or we've got to stop that because we've had intelligence, the more you are constantly ramping up the fear. So people are in a state of constant unease. And note this, because, you know, as I've been saying now for 20 odd years, this is a mind game. This is it's why my last book before the new one was called The Perception Deception, because that's what it all is. It's manipulating perception to manipulate human behavior, which comes from human perception. And so all the time, people are being given a perception that they're in constant danger. And note the targets overwhelmingly. They are places, whether it's mass shootings in America, whether it's terrorist attacks in Europe, whether it's terrorist attacks on the beach in Tunisia, they are all in places where people would normally feel absolutely safe. So if it can happen there, it can happen to me. You're sitting in a bar in Paris. Do you think anyone sits in a bar in Paris these days without having one eye open? Mm. And you know, you're taking your children to school in America after these school attacks, and you're thinking, will I see my child again? Will it happen here? Now, the chances of it happening in terms of a terrorist attack, especially a non-engineered one, and a school shooting, are closing in on almost zero. But that doesn't matter. Fear does not rationalize. It just fears. Anxiety doesn't rationalize. It just is in a state of anxiety.
Well, that's true. You know, I don't live too far from London. I have to travel in there from time to time, although I try and minimize the trips in. And whenever I'm on the train or on the underground, the tube in London, I feel uneasy these days. And I know that that's probably irrational, because the chances of me being involved in anything like that are probably, you know, slim to none. But nevertheless, I feel concerned.
And if you feel concerned, and not necessarily you, but many, 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 many people, if you feel concerned, if you feel in fear, then you are far, far more open to having your freedoms taken away, to in your mind, protect you from what you have been manipulated to fear. And the mind sequence goes like this. Well, I don't want this to happen. I don't want this freedom taken away. I don't want this surveillance. But in the circumstances, what else can we do? This is the state of mind that these perception deception events are manipulating. And so what you do, because the number of people manipulating are a tiny fraction of those who are being manipulated, you need the manipulated to agree and even campaign for their own freedoms being deleted. This is what's happening. People are being manipulated to demand their own prison cell. And this is the level that of maturity and awareness we need to look at this and not get caught in these diversionary debates. Like I say, should Americans have guns or not? Well, that's a debate, but it ain't the one we should be having at the moment. It's why are these guns being taken away at a time that the police state is being given military stunning levels of military equipment?
Now, David, you told me at the top of this that, of course, we know that you've been working for 30 years on all of this. You've reached the point where ordinary people call-in shows on the radio in London and recite some of the points in your books.
Yeah.
We've got to the point where people don't trust the mainstream media quite as much as they did, and I think that's a good thing. But in order to be able to take on what you're talking about, this nexus, this network, that's going to take how many years and how much effort?
What it's going to take is awareness. You see, you take a massive flock of sheep, a massive flock of sheep can be directed where to go by a sheepdog and a shepherd, but only because the sheep give their power away to the authority figure, the shepherd, and the symbol of fear, the sheepdog. If those sheep refused to cooperate with the sheepdog and the sheepdog and the shepherd would have no power whatsoever.
But it's in the sheep's nature to cooperate and act as a group. Similarly, it's probably in our nature to do that too.
Well, it's in the nature that we've been manipulated to have, throughout known human history, if you look at it. And this is the point I'm making in Phantom Self, because what I call Phantom Self is the perception that we are our name, our race, our sex, our income bracket, our background, our life story. We're not. That is what we are experiencing. What we are is a state of awareness, a state of being aware. And if you clear their minds of bodies and form and all these things, and just focus on a state of awareness, then people will start to get a much vaster appreciation of who we are and what our power to change things really is.
So do you believe that if people en masse, and you know some of this is happening, I'm sure, if they start to change their mindset, then somehow, because we're all connected, and I do believe that, then things can change?
Well, things are changing. The thing is that because I've been doing this for so long, Howard, I've been able to see this happen. Because when I started out, I couldn't speak, or I couldn't walk down any street in Britain without being laughed at. Going into a pub would waste of time. It was uproar, just complete ridicule. So I've seen this ridicule, this reflex action dismissal, what a joke, dilute and dilute. And it was slow at first. And then it got quicker and quicker. And after 9/11, it got quicker. After weapons of mass destruction weren't found in Iraq, it got quicker. And now we've reached a point where it's really starting to motor. And I know that because of the kind of people who are saying, well, hold on a minute, this is starting to make sense. I won't name names for their out of respect for them, but we are talking journalists, we are talking company directors, we are talking people of the system.
So people of the system are starting to contact you, David, and tell you, David, actually, we believe you. You were right.
No, what they're saying is it's starting to make sense of a world where the official story does not. And some people are saying that in these situations, yes.
And what about the mainstream media that feeds us more and more showbiz news and more trash? Look, I turned on my computer today and I've got it set to come up on a news website. And guess what? The top story was Britney Spears. Remember her? Britney Spears stuck in her harness while making a video. That was the big story. Now, when you're feeding people crap like that, how will you ever get the message across?
Well, the alternative media is breaking through big time. This is why there are more and more efforts to undermine it, not least by organizations like Google. I mean, Facebook are doing outrageous censorship of this sort of information. But you know, that's an interesting point you make. If you are a magician and you are about to do the trick, the sleight of hand with the left hand, you want the audience looking at the right.
Right.
And that's what the media are doing. And again, I go into this in Phantom Self in some detail. If you follow the sequence of what we call life, it is a software program. You come into the world and you are immediately influenced by parents who have been through exactly the same sequence that I'm about to describe. So they, not through malevolence, but by being persuaded that this is how the world is and this is what is right, are downloading that those perceptions onto their children. Increasingly now, it's getting smaller and smaller. It's about 3 years, four the most, and we've got some crazy man in the education authority in Britain who's calling for children to start school at 2. They are in the system process at this earliest of ages. Immediately, they've been out the womb 2 or 3 years, and suddenly they're sitting in a chair in a classroom, and they're being told by an authority figure when they have to be there, when they can leave, when they can go to the toilet, when they can't, when they can talk, when they can't. And this goes through what we call the education system. And it's not an education system. It is a programming system. It's programming a sense of reality that will create the adult sense of reality. You then go on to college, or you go on a university, and you go through the same sequence. All the time, you're being tested in something called an exam to see if you've taken the programming or not. This is why people who question in class are called disruptive influences. Those that just absorb it and repeat it, they're called good scholars. And then you, through these formative years of your life, the earliest years through to the teenage years, you have been told the system via the state, the system's version of everything. And you go to university, you go to top universities like Oxford University. I've debated at the Oxford Union goodness knows how many times. I left school at 15 to play football, never took a major exam in my life. And I have never yet been asked a challenging question in a debate at the Oxford Union, because they're programs.
But David, I went through the system and I'm kicking against it now. So yes. What's happened to me?
Yes, because it is possible to do that. If you can retain consciousness beyond the program, then you can start to question the program. But most people don't do that. And they come to university and off they go. And what do? They go off into a specialization. They become a politician, like the major people in the Oxford Union do. They become a doctor. They become a scientist. They become a journalist, etc. And what they're doing is they're taking into these professions that actually are the system, the perceptions that have come from the same source. And so when you are someone who challenges this system, then those that have downloaded its perceptions will always respond against you. They'll either call you mad, or they'll call you dangerous.
So how do we make any progress, David? If it's all loaded against you, and if you're one of those people like me who are starting to question it all, there's no hope, is there?
Howard, it is a challenge. I hate underestimating that. But it is happening. It is happening. People are changing in greater and greater numbers. And like I said earlier, they are changing within the system. They're starting to question things. And one of the great things that the alternative media is doing is offering another explanation for events. I had a man, this is some years ago now, I did a talk at Earl's Court, some Earl's Court event, and I did a talk there. And I was talking about some of the things we've been talking about. And this man was a major executive of Shell in South America for the latter part of his career. He just retired, I think about a year or two earlier. And I didn't know who he was. He was in the audience, a nice suit on. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, "What you said today has just made sense of so much that happened to me when I was working for Shell that I didn't understand the significance of, now I do." And what the system does, it compartmentalizes everything fiercely. The system of what we call human society is actually structured in the same way as a secret society, where in a secret society, you have levels of degree, and you only know what is known or is claimed to be known in the degree above you when you are invited into that level of degree. It's fiercely compartmentalized. So the vast majority, this is the thing, you see, I said earlier about it's not black and white, it's shades of gray. People say it's the Freemasons. No, it's not. The Freemason network is a massive vehicle for this, as are other secret societies like the Knights of Malta and the Knights Templar, etc. But especially in these big secret society networks like the Freemasons, vast in its number, most of them are compartmentalized by the structure to have no idea about what the organization is really being used for. There was that wonderful example in the late 70s of Propaganda Due in Italy, when the home of the head of this P2 Freemasonry lodge in Rome, Licio Gelli, had his home raided, and they found the documents for P2, which was fundamentally manipulating the Vatican and was involved in the what was the murder of the Pope John Paul I, after 33 days, which is a very significant Freemasonic number. And what they found was that P2 was broken up into sections. Each section had a head, and that head knew who was in that section. And then there was another section, and there was another section. None of these sections knew who was in the other sections, or even that these sections existed. Only Gelli and the very few people around him knew who was in all of them. And among the P2 members, by the way, was Silvio Berlusconi, who later became many times Prime Minister of Italy. And so you had P2 members interacting with each other in mainstream society, government, military, intelligence, journalism, who had no idea that the other one was also a member of P2, but in a different section. So it's all compartmentalized. But
all rolling in the same direction.
Yes. Yeah. This is the point. You cannot have too many people knowing what's happening or it gets out. You have to fiercely compartmentalize. This is the same structure that intelligence agencies use, the so-called need-to-know technique, where people only need to know enough to make their contribution without knowing how their contribution connects with other contributions of people they don't even know exist. And this is how society works. Someone goes to work and they make a contribution to the European Union. They don't know how that connects with someone in a banking situation making a contribution to the way the banking system works. But ultimately, all these strands connect.
Okay, so you're letting the cat out of the bag. And in our final minutes, here we are at the gateway to 2016. We're only a couple of days into this new year. What kind of a difference would you like to make in 2016? What would you like to have changed? Because I think 2015 was a pretty significant year and a lot has changed. If you want to do this again in 1 year from now, what do you think will have changed? What will be better?
Can I say just one thing? I've been saying now since, 10, 12 years that 2016, 2017, 2018 are going to decide this. Because either we get enough people awake to start to break this down, or it will be far enough further forward to be very, very difficult to stop. Not impossible, but very much more difficult. And what I want is quite simple. I want to do, and this is why I'm going on this world tour. I'm talking in London and Manchester and all over Europe, America. I'm trying to get into do events in Australia.
But they've stopped your visa. They're delaying your visa, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, normally it takes most. They've delayed it before, but it's taken maybe 2 weeks, maybe three. We're now talking the visa application being made in September, and now they're completely ignoring me.
Why do you think that might be? Because I remember doing a radio show in Australia, and I actually went to Australia House in London, and they processed my visa that day.
Yeah, well, I can answer that question by what the member of the Australian Parliament has just said. Australia is in a pre-police state situation. And what he does in his speech, which you can get on my website, he details all the things that are happening in Australian society. There are all definitions of a pre-police state. I think you know, a bit less of the pre, the way we're going. And so they don't want people like me going in there and speaking to big audiences in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane, etc., and detailing over the period of like 9 hours and connecting all the dots to expose what's going on. They don't want that.
But you've been there before. You sell a lot of books. You're clearly not a threat to the state. They can't deny you a visa, can they?
Well, they can. Interestingly, in this period where they've been not responding to my visa request, they've actually been in the news, haven't they, for denying visas in outrageous situations. Mm. What is happening there are laboratories in the world where they make things happen, and they are experimenting in a way on what the public reaction is, what resistance there is, what the effect is.
So they're trying to see whether anybody in Australia and around the world kicks up a fuss if they don't let you in.
That's one of the things, yeah. Mm. That's absolutely one of the things, but that's only one of the things. But you see, when you've got a population which is as small as Australia, then you have a population that you can observe much easier than 300 million plus in America. You can still do that, but when you've got a population as small as Australia, you've got one that you can monitor. You can monitor the reactions. And you know, in my books over the years, I've published documents, official documents or insider documents, that talk about how this whole system works of manipulating public opinion. There's one called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, and it's all about manipulating public opinion to get them to respond the way you want and to demand what you want to introduce. It's systematic. They call it social engineering, but that doesn't really cut it. It's much deeper than that.
So when are you due to speak in Australia? Presumably you're doing Sydney and the major cities.
September 2016. No, what am I saying? No, that's America. No, this July.
Okay, so you haven't got very long to sort this out.
No, this is the point. This is what they're doing. If they came out and outright banned me, actually that would give me a lot of credibility. Why are they banning this guy? I thought he was a nutter. If they let me in, well, they let me in and I go and speak and all the rest of it. So what they're doing is delaying and delaying and delaying, because they know that the closer it gets to July, the less...
Well, they're going to mess up your tour.
Yeah, the less run-up time there is to make it a success.
Right.
And so we're going to have to pull if it goes on. I mean, we've got a date in mind around, you know, mid to late January, and after that we'd be ridiculous to go, because you couldn't generate the promotion necessary for them. But
David, let me know what happens about that, because that's I read about that on your website today, and I find that a fascinating situation. I just wonder, you know, what it is that they think that you would do that is a problem. But I think we've just heard in the last hour some of the things they might have a difficulty with.
I'll tell you a funny thing, Howard. Mm-hmm. I went into Melbourne in 2009, I had a visa to go in. It was just one talk in Melbourne. And I arrived at the airport. I got stopped. I got taken into this room, which was straight out of the Matrix. You know, when the Neo's in that room, it's bright white walls, no windows. And I had a document pushed in front of me by this border person who said, will you sign to say that you've read that? If you don't sign, then you're not coming in the country. And what it was telling me that this was what it said, if you create discord, you will be removed from the country and not allowed back in. I mean, look at the definition of discord. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you know, good God, how many people...
Someone shouts out, I don't agree with you. Is that discord? Well, I mean, what's going on?
You think about the number of religious leaders and other people that they will have allowed quite freely into the country. David, we're going to have to park it there. Just one quick question. Yep. I don't know whether you can answer this in a minute or two. One of my listeners asked me something that I thought I'd refer to you, and we can't name names, and you know why, because I try and try as far as possible to avoid legal situations this, because I'm minimally resourced like you are. Satanism is one of the things that was raised by one of my emailers, and I just interested to know whether you think people in the upper echelons of society are still practicing that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I talk about it in great detail in my books. When you get into the upper echelons, so-called upper echelons, I call them the cesspit echelons of society, you get up into that 1% or less, and all the minions and offshoots from that, all the gophers, etc., you find a recurring theme. One is Satanism, and the other one is paedophilia. And Satanism and paedophilia go together for reasons I explain in the book, although it takes a little while to put the dots together. And that's why, whether it's Australia, whether it's America, whether it's Britain, these VIP paedophile rings keep coming to light, and then someone comes in and hammers them down. It's because it's so prevalent in the upper cesspit levels of society, it's breathtaking. And I've been researching these subjects, the ones you bring up now, since the mid-1990s, and have continued to this day. And I could talk for hours about it.
Well, I think we have to do a show on it, and you know, we'll chart our way through it very carefully for obvious reasons. But David, listen, it's going to be a very busy, and from what you said about 2016, 2017, a pretty crucial year for you. So look, I wish you the very best of luck with it all. And please keep me posted about that situation with Australia, because we need to talk more about that. But okay, David, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, mate. All the best.
Good to talk to you again. Give my love to the Isle of Wight.
I will. Bye.
Take care. Well, always what one of my bosses in radio used to call a lively discussion. You can always guarantee that with David Icke, and David will return to this show. Fascinating man, and a man in many ways who was a pathfinder for some people who are saying things now that he was saying years ago. He is controversial. Some people love him, some people hate him, but you cannot disagree with the success the man has whenever he goes to a theatre and does one of his various speaking engagements. He always packs the place out, and his books continue to sell both in the United States and the UK and around the world, massive volumes. So I'm personally always grateful to get David Icke on this show. I'll put a link to him and his work on my website, theunexplained.tv. Go there now if you'd like to send me an email or maybe make a donation to the show. Please do that. And please keep the email coming, because I need to know you're there and I need to know what you think of the show. Can't do it without you. Until next we meet here on The Unexplained, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London, and please stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.